Korban Pesach is not vegetarian. It is a lamb or a goat, and it's eaten. So we're going to go back to continue what we started last week of the idea of using animals for our sacrifices, why that is not barbaric. We ended last week with the idea that anyone who eats meat and uses animals for leather shoes, leather coats, leather skirts, uses animals for medicines, any similar kind of thing, or plays tennis with rackets that are made of catgut, or any other use of animals, can't complain that we use animals for sacrifices, because if you can use animals for your own mundane uses, definitely you can use them in service of God. How about people who do not use animals for any of these things? And they feel that animal life has to be protected. And animals should not be used in the service of human beings, because animals are our peers in this world, per se. They're also living beings, and therefore should not be used by human beings in any way that takes away their rights, okay, their right to live, or whatever. Okay, that in itself is problematic, because the Torah tells us that the world was created for the sake of man, and every single thing, including the animal kingdom, were created to serve man. And therefore, man has a right to use and utilize all of these things. And there is no idea of balpashris, of destroying wantonly things in the world if they're used for a purpose that man needs, whatever that purpose may be. And animals were given after the time of Noah. We'll speak about before the time of Noah in a little while. But after the time of Noah, the Torah says openly that man has the right to eat animals. And animals were given to man to eat, just like vegetables. Just like the plant world was given to man to eat, so were animals given. The simplest idea, we'll go into some more deeper ideas, but the simplest idea is, since after the flood, all animal life can attribute its existence to man, because Noah spent a year feeding these animals and taking care of them, so he gained the right to eat them. They now became food for man. So since the Torah says that man is allowed to eat animals, to have a philosophy that says it's wrong to eat animals is against the Torah. And any philosophy that disagrees with the Torah is called apikursis. So says the Chafetz Chaim and Mishneh Berurah. Anything that's not kedash haTorah is apikursis. And apikursis and apikores is the antithesis of what Torah is. So to have a philosophy that it is wrong philosophically for man to eat meat or to utilize animals for his needs is a philosophy that is at odds with the Torah. So if someone is a vegetarian philosophically, it is something that is out of the pale of the Torah. Yes? What?
Going on
what
you said about using animals,
yeah.
What bothers me is we don't take pleasure, we're not happy about the act of killing. And it worries me that we are using this specific act which we can't take any pleasure in or be happy about to serve God. I'd rather, you know,
we'll discuss this idea of killing animals and how a person has to relate to that idea of the animal having to be killed, having its life taken away. That we'll discuss in a few seconds. So in any case, more than that, someone who ideologically is a vegetarian, right, leads him usually to worse aberrations, not only in ideology, but in actual practice, which we'll get to in a second. Let me explain to you first why before the flood, man was not allowed to kill animals and eat meat. Before the flood, man was not really a vegetarian, because according to many opinions, man was allowed to eat meat, but he wasn't allowed to kill animals to eat meat. It says that the angels used to bring animals and roast them for Adam HaRishon and feed him meat. So Adam HaRishon was not necessarily a vegetarian, but he wasn't allowed to kill animals for his food. Now, why? So one reason we said already, because before the flood, the animals existed on their own, and man existed on his own. But after the flood, the animals existed because man saved them from the flood by God's command. And man had to bother himself for a year to save and give these animals a way to survive. And because the animals now can attribute their existence to man, man had a right now to kill them and to eat them. That's one idea. There are two other ideas. And both of them bring out the idea of why we eat meat and the benefit to the animal from it, not just the benefit to man. The one idea is, the Sfarno says this, that let me tell you the Sfarno says, then I'll tell you the second thing. This is not what I intended to say. The Sfarno says the following, that before the flood, the world was in a much more ideal state than it was after the flood. The flood caused a very intense effect for the negative on the world. One of the things that happened after the flood that didn't exist before the flood is climate. The climates before the flood were basically all equator-type climates. The most, there weren't harsh winters and harsh summers. There was more like a regular climate all over the world. The reason for that is, what changes the seasons? The fact that the Earth is tilted on its axis. So at different times of the year, the Earth is either getting more direct sunlight or less direct sunlight. Where it gets less direct sunlight is winter, more direct sunlight is summer. And then spring and autumn fit in there also. Before the flood, the world was not tilted on its axis, seemingly the way the Sfarno says, and therefore the climate was all moderate. There weren't changes between summer, winter, spring, and autumn. It was a more equatorial, what happens by the equator today. There aren't any seasons of summer, winter, spring, and autumn, but it's all moderate weather the entire year. And under the ideal circumstances of before the flood, people lived a lot longer. The plant life was able to grow in a way that it would nourish all of man's needs. So he didn't have to eat meat. After the flood, when the world became less of an ideal place, and therefore the climates became a factor, and plant life could not develop to the extent that it could develop before the flood, then plants, vegetables, seeds, grain could no longer give man all of the nutrients that he needed, and he needed to supplement his diet with meat. This is what the Sfarno says. So therefore, before the flood, it wasn't necessary for man to eat meat, and therefore he couldn't take advantage of the animals if it's not necessary. That's called baltashkes. It's destructive if it's not a necessity for man. And it's also tsar balechayim. You are giving the animals undue pain that's not necessary. anything that is necessary for man, if man has a need for it, then there's no idea of tzar balichayim. There's no idea of giving pain to an animal. There's no prohibition of paining an animal if man has a need for that animal to be pained. For instance, if we want to do experiments on animals in order to benefit human beings, right? There was recently in the newspapers this organization of Tein Chayot Lichyot, give animals the right to live, animals' rights, right? Which to a certain degree is, there's a place for that. That people should not wantonly destroy or harm or hurt animals. It's a total prohibition to hurt animals unnecessarily. But what they go overboard is that where it's necessary for human beings, they also feel that human beings have no more rights than animals. We'll get to that philosophically in a few seconds, where that comes from. But in any case, from the Torah standpoint, if you are wantonly destroying anything in this world, not only animals, plants, minerals, wanton destruction is a Torah prohibition called Bal Tashlis. Wanton destruction, it's not to destroy things in this world for no purpose, is destructive and it's wrong and it's a Torah prohibition. Also, to pain animals, this only applies to animals, any kind of animal, unnecessarily is a Torah prohibition. But both of those prohibitions don't apply if there's a necessity for man. If people need to make experiments on animals in order to benefit human beings, in the army they make experiments to know how animals react to trauma so they'll know how to deal with human beings. And that saves human beings from pain. So it is 100% permissible to pain animals for the sake of human beings. That's what animals were created for. They were created to serve man. And therefore, if the pain inflicted on the animal is necessary for a human being, purpose, other than just wanton, unnecessary means, then the prohibition of paining the animal, tzar balichayim, does not apply. Same thing goes, it's not destructive if there's a purpose why man needs to kill that animal or destroy it. If there's a reason, there's a need for it, then it's okay. The note of Yehuda has a tshuva. Somebody asked him about hunting. Is it okay to hunt? And either for the sport or because he wanted to hunt animals for their hide or for their fur. So the note of Yehuda said like this. There are two possible prohibitions. One is causing pain to an animal, and the other is wanton destruction. Both of those don't apply if the person has a need to hunt those animals. Then you're allowed to pain the animal if you have a need, and it's not wanton destruction. Even though you're killing the animal, and you're not going to be able to eat the flesh, or you're killing an animal that's not kosher, so you're going to throw away most of the animal. All you want is the hide or the fur. That's also okay. The only way you can get that fur off the animal, you can't ask the animal to take it off. So the only way you can get it is by killing the animal and taking it off. That's okay. Even though it involves pain to the animal and it involves, destroying most of the animal. But there's a reason, there's a purpose. So those prohibitions don't apply, says the Note of Yehuda. However, the Note of Yehuda says, I'm wondering, he says, what kind of Jew would want to be a hunter? That was the profession of Esav. Esav's a hunter. Esav goes out and hunts animals for sport. Jews don't do that. Even if there's no specific prohibition, but the cruelty of just hunting animals for sport, that in itself is not a Jewish thing. Doesn't engender Jewish feeling. So there is an idea that even though these prohibitions don't apply necessarily, of wanton destruction or the idea of causing pain to an animal, stop hunting animals for sport is not a Jewish thing to do. That's what the Note of Yehuda says. Now in any case, but once there was a need, so before the flood, there wasn't a need to eat meat. Since there wasn't a need, it would be destructive and it would be undue pain to an animal to kill it and to eat it for no reason. After the flood, meat became a necessary supplement to people's diets because there was a need, therefore it was permitted. And even though it could be there are people who can exist without eating meat, but to a certain degree, most people need meat, fish, in their diet. Okay, that's one idea. But there are deeper ideas, though. Another idea is that which animals and plants and minerals were created for the sake of man is not just to be utilized by man to fulfill his needs, for man's sake, but it's also for the sake of these things. The whole world was created to get closer to God. God created an imperfect world that man should perfect and bring the world closer to God. Man is the only free-willed being who can come closer to God on his own. All the other things in the world come closer to God through man, by man utilizing them for higher purposes. On the simplest level, everything serves the thing in the level above it. Minerals are ingested by plants, and therefore the mineral is raised to a higher level by becoming part of the plant. Plants are eaten by animals, so they are raised up one level from the vegetable to the animal by serving the animal. Animals are eaten by human beings and used by human beings, which elevate them to a higher level of the human. They become part of the human being and they're used by the human being, and therefore they are elevated to the next highest level. And man serves God, elevates him to the highest level. Okay. Before the flood, man was able to elevate the animals externally by using them, by influencing them, by coming in contact with them in an external way and making use of them. Man elevated the animal to a higher level. After the flood, man's influence on the world was curtailed, because what happened by the flood is that man with his sins influenced the world negatively and caused the world to have to be destroyed. After the flood, God minimized man's effect on the world, his influence over the world, so he could never have such a negative influence that would necessitate the world being destroyed. Man basically polluted the world spiritually. And when you have spiritual pollution, how do you get rid of it? Sometimes what you do is you put it in a mikveh. Something that's spiritually polluted, you put into a mikveh. That's how you get rid of tumah. So what did God do to make the world pure of the spiritual pollution that man caused? He put the whole world into a mikveh. That's called the flood. So he totaled the world in the mikveh of the flood and purified the world. In any case, after the flood, God limited man's effect, his influence on the world, and man could no longer pollute the world in an extreme way, nor could he use his influence to elevate the world in an extreme way. So now he could no longer elevate the animals by using them, but he had to elevate them by eating them. By eating the animals, he ingested them, they became part of him, and the animal became raised from the animal state to the human state by becoming part of human beings. So in actuality, man now gave the animal the ability to be perfected through eating. So the truth is that by killing the animal and eating it, you are enabling the animal to reach its tachlis. And that is a chesed, that's a kindness to the animal. It's for the animal's sake. It's not only for man's sake, it's for the animal's sake. The animal reaches its perfection by being subservient to man, by being used by man, and being eaten by man. And in addition, however, the Gemara does say the following. The Gemara says that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, a little sheep once came and nudged itself against him, as if to say, on its way to the slaughter, help me. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi turned to the sheep and he said, go and be slaughtered, because that's what you were created for. And he was punished for making that statement. And he had, I think, a terrible toothache for I don't know how many years because of this. He was given suffering because he was insensitive to that sheep. Now what does that mean? Before I just told you that it's for the benefit of the sheep. The sheep reaches its purpose through being slaughtered and through being eaten by human beings and used by human beings in service of God. So why shouldn't Rabbi Yehudah say what he said? The answer is, on the one hand, that's true. But since it has to happen through Shechita and through the animal losing its life, it has to happen in a way that is less than ideal. You can't take too much pleasure in the fact that the animal has to be killed. On the one hand, that's the way God made the world, and that's necessary. And it's to the animal's benefit. But since it has to happen in a way that is through killing the animal, on the one hand, you can't be too overjoyed with killing the animal. And that's why it says in the Beis HaMikdash, the Kohanim, who came from the Midah of Chesed, of kindness, didn't shech the animals. Other people shechted them, not the Kohen. The Kohen didn't shech animals. From our Gemara, not from Kabbalah, it just says you don't need a Kohen. Any Jew can shech the sacrifice. The Kohen is only needed from the receiving of the blood and onwards. But sacrifice, what you call shechting the animal, slaughtering the animal, can be done by a regular Jew. In the Zohar, it says, not only can it be done by a regular Jew, it has to be done by a regular Jew, because the Kohen is not allowed to get involved in killing. This killing is for a purpose, and it elevates the animal, but it's still killing. So, even though it's killing that's necessary, but it's still killing, and therefore there is some negative thing about it. And because of that, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi shouldn't have been so insensitive to this animal. He should have said to the animal, yes, I feel for you that you have to be slaughtered in order to be elevated, but you should realize that that was the reason you were created. But he was insensitive to the fact that the animal had to be killed to do this, therefore he was punished. So there is a balance over here. And therefore also how we kill the animal also has to be taken into consideration. Not to cause the animal any undue suffering, it's not necessary. But anything that makes it easier for a human being or more inexpensive for the human being is not called unnecessary suffering. That's necessary suffering. But anything that's totally unnecessary, it doesn't help the person financially or in any way make it easier to slaughter this animal, stop it causes the animal more pain, that's prohibited. So that's one idea. An idea that before the flood, man could elevate the animals without having to kill them and eat them. After the flood, that was impossible, so it became necessary to kill the animals and to eat them as part of man's elevation of the world towards God. The Sefer HaIkarim, Rabbi Yosef Albo, who is one of the Rishonim, says a different idea. And this goes back to this philosophical idea of feeling that it's wrong to take advantage of animals. He said that was the feeling before the flood. Before the flood, mostly Cain and his progeny did not feel that it's proper for man to take advantage of animals. And therefore, Cain was a farmer and not a shepherd. Hevel was a shepherd. Cain felt it was wrong to be a shepherd. It's wrong to take advantage of animals. And basically, that could elevate the animal to the level of human beings, but it didn't. When man equates animals with human beings, what usually happens is human beings are reduced to animals. And we become just another animal. And there's a very big difference between human beings and animals, because we have free choice, and we have a responsibility to make moral and ethical choices, and animals don't. But if you equate animals with human beings, then human beings are also just another bunch of animals who can do whatever it comes to the natural. And that's what happened in the world we live in today. Since evolution, we put man a notch above all the other animals, we are another animal who's just evolved a little bit more, but we are also animals. That gives license for people to act like animals. It's exactly what happens in the world. I once heard on the radio in Miami, many years ago, a study that they spent thousands, tens of thousands of dollars on. I could have saved them a lot of money. They didn't need a study. What was the study? This is when gay rights were a big issue, with a breakthrough. Now, today it's pretty much accepted. But then it was an issue. And just let me make it clear, I have nothing against gay people per se, except for the fact that they are doing something that is against the Torah, just like other people who speak Lashon Hara, steal, murder, or whatever, do things against the Torah, and that's not a proper thing to do. But more than anybody else who does things against the Torah, they shouldn't be discriminated against. But when you make it legitimate, and you make it an alternate lifestyle, it's as ridiculous as saying that, well, stealing is an alternate lifestyle. Some people steal, some people don't. Right? Some people murder, some people don't. Murdering is just an alternate lifestyle. Right? Some people are cannibals, some people aren't. It's just an alternate lifestyle. That's ridiculous. It is something that's prohibited, and it's awesome. It's prohibited, it's wrong. So cannibalism is wrong, and stealing is wrong, and murder is wrong, and homosexuality, if you take it to its extreme, where you act upon it and perform homosexual acts, that's wrong, according to the Torah. And that, which some people say, I don't know how we got on this tangent, but okay, it's important because I want to bring out this point. Some people say, well, it's natural in some people to have these desires, same-sex desires. Whether that's true or not is irrelevant. Because let me tell you something, it's natural in most of us, I hope, to have desires, heterosexual desires. And still the Torah says you have to control it and not use it the wrong way. So even if it be natural to have homosexual desires in some people, that doesn't make it okay to do things that are wrong. It means you have to control those desires and not use them, right, in a way that's prohibited. Even if you have the desire, it doesn't mean you have to act upon it. Just as much as if you have desire to eat, and the only thing around to eat is ham, and it's not a matter of life and death, but you can't eat the ham. How you have this natural desire to eat ham, so what? The Torah said you're not allowed to do it. So the fact that there can be natural attractions to things that are prohibited is no big fiddish, right? Unless I'm different than everybody else, I have a lot of natural desires for things that are prohibited. But I'm supposed to control myself and not do it. Same thing goes for people who have that desires for things that are not necessarily shared by other people, right? They also have to control themselves and not act upon those desires. Having the desires themselves are not necessarily what's prohibited. It's doing things according to those desires, and that we're all in the same boat. We all have desires for things that are prohibited. We have to control them. So, in any case, getting back to, oh, and legitimizing it, making it an alternate lifestyle, where you have shuls for gay people, right? Where gay people can get married. Where you can write, it says, you know when the flood came? When they started writing tshuvas between men and men and women. The flood. When they tried to legitimize these things and not say it's a prohibition. When it became legitimate, then it's a problem. Okay, an alternate lifestyle. Right? So to have shuls of gay people, right? A gay shul, it's not a shul where everybody's happy. Right? So if you understand what I'm talking about, fine. If not, right, we're not talking about shuls where everybody's besimcha. In Miami, they had gay shuls. Big problem with the mechitza. How exactly everybody had a little mechitza around themselves. In any case, the problem was not that gay people shouldn't be allowed in shul. They shouldn't be allowed in shul. Just as much as you let people speak Lashon Hara come to shul and do other sins. We don't throw people who do sins out of shul, because if we did, we'd have no shuls. And probably no rabbis either. People sin. But to make a shul, this is a shul for people who speak Lashon Hara. If you come to this shul, you have to speak Lashon Hara. That's absurd. This is a shul for Ganav. This is the Ganav in shul. Anybody joining the shul has to steal. That's absurd. The same absurdity, this is a shul for people who transgress the Torah when it comes to sexual things. This is absurd. That's wrong. In any case, so what was the study, getting back to what I wanted to say? The study was that they found that a certain percentage of horses were naturally homosexual, which means that a certain percentage of human beings also, therefore, are naturally homosexual, therefore it's okay. Now, I could have saved them a lot of money, and I could have made their conclusions much more relevant than just the homosexuality. Do you know there are a certain percentage of lions that are cannibals that usually eat human beings? Therefore, cannibalism is okay, because since it exists by a certain percentage of lions, it should be okay for a certain percentage of human beings. So certain human beings are not cannibals, but there's a certain percentage that should be cannibals because it applies to lions. And if you want to take this ad, right, we can, the animals do a lot of things that are animalistic. And if that's okay for the animal, if it's okay for the animal, it's okay for the human being, then you can remaster a lot of things for human beings that are okay as an alternate lifestyle. Yet it may be true that certain horses are homosexual. They're horses. Just like certain animals are cannibals. They're animals. That's okay for an animal. A human being may have attractions to things that are prohibited, but they're expected to control themselves. That's the difference between an animal and a human being. Animals do what comes naturally, and people control themselves and don't do what comes naturally. So there's no connection between an animal and a human being. But if you are a devotee of secular evolutionism, godless evolution, that animals and people are the same thing, we're all part of an evolutionary process, and we are animals just a little bit higher than the other animals, and there's no difference between us. And what's good for the animal is good for the person. And that's exactly what happens in the world, where we're allowed to act like animals because we are animals. And that's what happens when you raise animals to the level of human beings. You don't sanctify them, but you lower human beings to the level of the animal. And that's the world we live in. You don't need a Rabbi Yosef Alba to tell you that. That's exactly the problem with most of society today. People are just animals, and whatever goes for the animal goes for human beings. And we're treated like animals, we treat other people like animals. And therefore, says Rabbi Yosef Alba, after the flood, because this philosophy of equating animals and human beings made people act like animals, worse than animals, and they're the ones who polluted the animal world and necessitated even the animals to be destroyed. It's people who did that, not animals. So God said after the flood, I want you to eat animals, because I want you to know you're not an animal. And if you'd be an animal, you couldn't eat your peer. I don't want you to eat other human beings, I want you to eat animals. I want you to know you're not an animal. And that would help to give people the understanding that they are something different than an animal, have to act differently. That's why meat was permitted. And therefore, someone who says, I don't need meat, and therefore I don't need to kill animals in order to eat meat, and therefore it's not necessary for me. Or I don't think that meat is healthy, and I don't want to eat meat because it's not healthy. All of that is fine. No problem with that. But someone who says, I don't want to eat meat because it's wrong to eat animals. Philosophically, ideologically, that is apikoursis. And not only that, not only is it apikoursis, but it leads to people equating animals and human beings and being more concerned about animals than they are about human beings. The Nazis found nothing wrong, right, with killing human beings, Jews. But they were concerned about the dogs and the cats, the stray dogs and cats that were the pets of these Jews. That bothered them. Right, there was an animal rights group that sent a letter of protest to Arafat, Yimach Shemo v'Zichro, because he used a donkey as a suicide bomber. He filled the donkey with explosives. Baruch Hashem, nobody was hurt from it, except the donkey. And he blew up this donkey, and they protested that he, what's it called, he was cruel to this poor donkey. Somebody asked them on the BBC, I was shocked that the reporter asked the question, right, especially on the BBC. They asked, did you ever send a protest letter that these suicide bombers are killing human beings? Forget about donkeys. They said, so what was the answer of this idiot who's ahead of this animals rights group? We don't get involved in politics. That was the idiocy, idiotic answer that was given. Human beings being blown up, that's politics. Donkeys being blown up, that's horrendous. That's what happens when people equate animal rights and human rights. Animals have the right to serve man. And man has a responsibility to use animals properly and not abuse them. That's, and therefore, for man to bring sacrifices from animals, that's the highest level of the animal. The animal becomes a carbon to the Rabbanim. That is the highest level. Let me tell you something interesting, which may sound strange to you, but in the next world, in the spiritual world, you know what is brought as sacrifices to God? The souls of tzaddikim. Michoel, the angel Michoel, is the Kohen Gadol in heaven, and he brings the souls of tzaddikim on an altar and sacrifices them to God. So in the next world, it's human beings that are brought as sacrifices, but not like we know now, having to kill them and hurt and pain. No, it's nothing to do with that. It's a level of raising the soul to a higher level. So in this world, the animal is raised to that higher level by using it as a sacrifice to God. So in this world, we don't use human beings as sacrifices. God prohibited that and made it clear through Akedas Yitzchak. He doesn't want human sacrifice. But we elevate the world by taking all the animal, vegetable, mineral, and elevating it, uniting it in service of God. So it's Arik, and it lets us understand what our place in the world is and what the place of everything else in the world is. Okay.
Rabbi,
yeah.
Tanya says that the human being has an animal soul and a spiritual soul.
Right. No, he says that there are aspects. The Rabbi says that we only have one soul. But the soul itself has many aspects to it. So there are animalistic sides to our soul that are the appetite and things that we share with other animals. Okay? With animals. In other words, animals also have an appetite. Animals also experience pain. Those things we share in common. There are aspects of our soul which are our intellect that animals don't have. There are aspects of our soul which are spiritual that animals don't have. It's not two different souls. It's one soul with various aspects. The difference is that when a human being has an appetite, it's a result of his spiritual soul. When an animal has an appetite, it's a result of his physical nefesh. Same appetite, but a different source. By us, the source of our appetite is our spiritual soul. By the animal, the source of his appetite is his physical life force. Two different things. Even though they seem to be the same, they're never the same. Human beings, even in those areas where they are similar to animals, but the source of those similarities are different. That's the idea. It's not two different souls. It's not that we have an animal soul and a human soul that exist, coexist together. We only have a human divine soul. But that human divine soul has certain aspects of it which are similar to things that the animal has. That's the idea. Yes?
Rabbi, can one agree 100% with every word you said?
Yes, you can.
And at the same time say that he or she does not wish to be an animal elevator. Yes, you are doing the animal elevator, but I just don't choose to be an animal elevator.
No. I'll tell you why.
Why?
Because since you can say, for whatever reason, I don't like meat. I don't like the idea of eating meat, right? I don't think it's healthy, whatever it may be, okay? Practical reasons. And therefore, I will choose to utilize the world in different ways. But if I say, look, God said that I should elevate the world in this manner. And I'm telling him, no, I don't think I like that doing that matter. That's averting your responsibility only because you don't think that that's what you want to do. That's wrong. But if I have a good reason why, I don't like meat. It disgusts me. I don't think it's healthy, right? I don't like the fact that, you know, you had to kill these animals. I once saw an animal get killed, and it just disgusts me now to think that, you know, eating meat after killing an animal or whatever, that's fine. Now, therefore, even though I know I have a responsibility to elevate the world, I'll choose other ways of doing it, not this, because this way practically doesn't appeal to me. But if it doesn't appeal to me ideologically, just because I don't like it, right? Not because there's any practical reason why I don't like it, I'll choose to elevate the world differently because I don't think this is really the way to do it, then it's an ideological problem. Okay? If it doesn't cross the line of ideology, it's okay. Once it crosses the line of ideology, it's a problem. Okay, now, so I shouldn't be a liar in print. Let's apply this to Korban Pesach. Korban Pesach, why do we bring a Passover sacrifice? So there are three or four different ideas that are given, and they fit into this general idea of utilizing the animal in service of God. Firstly, the lamb was a symbol of idolatry in Egypt. They worshipped the lamb. Not that they believed that little lambs were gods. They weren't fools, the Egyptians. They were extremely advanced people in every area, technology. But they understood that there were spiritual powers in heaven whose physical representation in this world was a lamb. And they worshipped those spiritual powers. The spiritual power in heaven of the month of Nisan is the lamb. It's not the lamb we see here as a physical being. It's a power called the power of the lamb. It's a constellation. It's represented by the stars. But in this world, it's represented by an animal that's called a lamb. And therefore, they used to deify that representation of that power, that spiritual power that they serve, by deifying the physical lamb in this world. And not eating it, and like the holy cows in India. And to show that we totally vanquished the idolatry of Egypt, and it wasn't that power of Nisan, of the lamb, that took us out of Egypt, it was God, we slaughter the lamb, we roast it, so you can see clearly that it's a lamb that's being roasted, we don't cut it apart, we roast it whole, so you can see that the lamb, symbolically what we're doing, is taking the idolatry of Egypt and burning it, destroying it. And then we eat it. Why do we eat it? To show that not only do we negate its evil, but we take it and use it for good. We can eat it too. Now the lamb serves us, we don't serve the lamb. The lamb is a good meal, good Pesach Seder, right? Lamb chops. Today you can't do that. But when there's a Korban Pesach, that was the main course, lamb chops. Roasted lamb chops, what could be better? Right? Does anybody remember that? No. In any case, so not only do we negate the idolatry, but it's not we who serve the lamb, it's the lamb who serves the needs of man. That's one idea in Korban Pesach. Second idea is the lamb, the Maharal Prague says, represents unity. It's a small animal. We take it and we roast it whole, which represents the unity of the Jewish people. We're compared to sheep. The Jewish people are compared to sheep. And the one lamb represents the unity of the Jewish people. And the fact that God redeemed us from Egypt is a sign that the Jews have to unite under God and unify Him. The unity of the Jewish people represents the unity of God. When we're unified, then we more feel that unity of God. So it also represents the unity of God, slaughtering this animal to God, that there aren't many, many powers in the world. Therefore, we eat it with matzah and maror. The matzah and maror represent good and bad, the bitterness and the good, the redemption and the slavery. Everything unifies under God. The good, the bad, everything is part of one unified, godly, divine purpose in the world. So the Korban Pesach represents the negation of idolatry. Because it negates idolatry, it represents the unity of God, that everything emanates from Him. There are no separate powers. And if God is one, then His nation, Klal Yisrael, is also one. Atah Echad, V'Shimcha Echad, you're one, your name is one. Umi Ka'amcha Yisrael, Goy Echad Boris. And the Jewish people are one, in one land in Eretz Yisrael. When we are unified and all together in Eretz Yisrael, we represent the oneness of God. So the Korban Pesach represents all these ideas. They all blend together. They represent the negation of idolatry, the oneness of God, the oneness of the Jewish people. and all, and then when the Jewish people are one and they utilize everything in the world in service of God, then we are like the kings. That represents, we eat it in a royal manner to show that man is the king of the world. King meaning that he unites everything in the world, all the animal, vegetable, mineral, in service of God. So everything about the Korban Pesach represents this idea of total unity, of unifying everything, all of creation, all of the Jewish people, the negation of idolatry, which breaks up the world into different powers, right? It fractionalizes the world instead of uniting everything. What was the word?
Fragments.
That's the word. Thank you. It fragments the world. Fragmentizes. That's the word. It fragmentizes everything in the world instead of uniting it. So all those concepts are the concepts of the Korban Pesach, and they all really emanate from one source. I wish you all a chag kosher and sameach, and I'll see you after Pesach.